The medical team Molly employed occupied two floors of an anonymous condo rack near Old Baltimore. Case met Molly as she emerged. She was limping. He says if I kick anything, it'll fall off. I ran into one of your pals, Case said. Lupus Yonder Boy had a message. He passed her a paper napkin with Wintermute printed in red felt pen. He said, but her hand came up in the jive for silence. After lunch in Baltimore, they tubed into New York. Beyond the army blanket, the Finn waited at the white table. Molly produced a scrap of paper, wrote something on it, and passed it to the Finn. He nodded, took a flat little console from his pocket, and punched out an elaborate sequence. Honey, the Finn said, that's an AI. Burn. It's got limited Swiss citizenship, built for Tessier Ashpool SA. They own the mainframe and the original software. What's in burn, okay? Kay stepped between them. Wintermute is the recognition code for an artificial intelligence. I've got the Turing registry numbers. If Yonder Boy's right, this AI is backing Armitage. I paid Larry to have the moderns nose around Armitage a little, Molly explained, turning to Case. They have some very weird lines of communication. Deal was, they'd get my money if they answered one question. Who's running Armitage? And you think it's this AI, Case asked? Those things aren't allowed any autonomy. It'll be the parent corporation, this Tessel. Tessier Ashpool, S.A., said the Finn. And I got a little story for you about them. The story he told Case and Molly began with another man's story, a man he called Smith. Smith was also a fence, but in balmier seasons he surfaced as an art dealer. Smith had come to the Finn with a request. He wanted a go-to on the Tessier Ashpool clan. Smith, it developed, had had a supplier known as Jimmy. Jimmy was a burglar, and just back from a year in high orbit. The most unusual thing Jimmy had managed to score on his swing through the archipelago was an intricately worked bust, cloisonné over platinum, studded with seed pearls and lapis. The thing was a computer terminal, he said. It could talk. And not in a synth voice, but with a beautiful arrangement of gears and miniature organ pipes. Smith's clientele included a Tokyo billionaire whose passion for clockwork automata approached fetishism. Smith shrugged. He could try, he said, but he doubted he could get much for it. When Jimmy had gone, leaving the head, Smith went over it carefully. It had been commissioned, he discovered, by Tessier Ashpool S.A. Smith began to make preliminary passes at the Tokyo collector, and then he had a visitor. A small man, Japanese, enormously polite, who bore all the marks of a vat-grown ninja assassin. The cloned killer explained that it was his duty to find a certain artwork which had been taken from his master. It had come to his attention that Smith might know the whereabouts of this object. Smith told the man that he had no wish to die and produced the head. And how much, his visitor asked, did you expect to obtain through the sale of this object? Smith named a figure. The ninja produced a credit chip and keyed Smith that amount out of a numbered Swiss account. And who, the man asked, brought you this piece? Smith told him. Within days, Smith learned of Jimmy's death. So that was where I came in, the Finn continued. Smith knew I dealt a lot with the Memory Lane crowd, and that's where you go for a quiet go-to that'll never be traced. I hired a cowboy. Well, I had my cowboy buzz the news morgues until we found Tessier Ashpool in litigation. The case wasn't anything, but we got the law firm. Then we did the lawyer's ice and we got the family address. A lot of good it did us. Case raised his eyebrows. Freeside, the Finn said. The spindle. Turns out they own damn near the whole thing. Family organization. Corporate structure. Supposedly you can buy into an S.A., but there hasn't been a share of Tessier Ashpool traded on the open market in over 100 years. You're looking at a very quiet, very eccentric first-generation high-orbit family, run like a corporation. Big money, very shy of media, a lot of cloning. Orbit the law's a lot softer on genetic engineering, right? And it's hard to keep track of which generation or combination of generations is running the show at a given time. How's that? Molly asked. Got their own cryogenic setup. Even under orbital law, you're legally dead for the duration of a freeze. Looks like they trade off, though nobody's seen the Founding Father in about 30 years. Founding Mama, she died in some lab accident. You figure they own that ninja fin? Molly asked. Smith thought so. Expensive, she said. Wonder whatever happened to that little ninja fin. Probably got him on ice, Finn said. Thaw when needed. Okay, Case said, we got Armitage getting his goodies off an AI named Wintermute. Where's that get us? Nowhere yet, Molly said, but you got a little side gig now. She drew a folded scrap of paper from her pocket and handed it to him. He opened it. Grid coordinates and entry codes. Who's this? Armitage. Some database of his. Bought it from the moderns. Where is it? London, Case said. Crack it, she said. It was disturbing to think of the flatline as a construct, a hardwired ROM cassette replicating a dead man's skills, obsessions, knee-jerk responses. Case lost himself in memories of the flatline. He'd spent most of his 19th summer in the Gentleman Loser, nursing expensive beers and watching the cowboy. He'd never touched a deck then, but he knew what he wanted. There were at least 20 other hopefuls ghosting the loser that summer, each one bent on working Joe Boy for some cowboy. No other way to learn. They'd all heard of Pauly, the redneck jockey from the Atlanta fringes who'd survived a brain death behind black ice. The grapevine had little to say about Pauly, other than that he'd done the impossible. It was big, another would-be told Case, for the price of a beer. But who knows what? I hear maybe a Brazilian payroll net. Anyway, the man was dead, flat-down brain death. The cowboy elite and the loser shunned Pauly out of some strange group anxiety, almost a superstition. McCoy Pauly, Lazarus of cyberspace. He turned on the tensor beside the Hosaka. The crisp circle of light fell directly on the flatline's construct. He slotted some ice, connected the construct, and jacked in. It was exactly the sensation of someone reading over his shoulder. Hey, Dix, McCoy, that you, man?
Hey, bro.
It's Case, man, remember?
Miami, Joe Boy, quick study.
What's the last thing you remember before I spoke to you, Dix?
Nothing.
Hang on, Case said. He disconnected the construct. The presence was gone. He reconnected it. Hey, Dix, who am I?
You got me hung, Jack. Who the fuck are you?
Your buddy, partner. What's happening, man?
Good question.
Remember being here a second ago?
No.
Know how an ROM personality matrix works?
Sure, bro. It's a firmware construct.
So I jack into the bank I'm using. I can give it sequential real-time memory?
I guess so, said the construct.
Okay, Dix. You are an ROM construct. Got me?
If you say so, said the construct. Who are you?
Case.
Miami, said the voice. Joe Boy, quick study.
Right. And for starts, Dix, you and me, we're going to segue over to London Grid and access a little data. You game for that?
You going to tell me I got a choice, boy?
With the flatline's help, Case connected with the London database that Molly claimed was Armitage's. Scan this shit, Case told the Hosaka. Sift for owner's personal history. Contents are primarily video recordings of post-war military trials, said the voice of the Hosaka. Central figure is Colonel Willis Corto. A man's face filled the screen. The eyes were Armitage's. 2 hours later, Case fell beside Molly on the temper foam. You find anything? She asked. Tell you later, he said. I'm wrecked. He was hungover and confused. He lay there, eyes closed, and tried to sort the various parts of a story about a man called Corto. The Hosaka had audio recordings of the Screaming Fist hearings. Willis Corto, colonel, had plummeted through a blind spot in the Russian defenses over Kerensk. The shuttles had created the hole with pulse bombs, and Corto's team had dropped in night-wing microlights. The microlights had been unarmed, stripped to compensate for the weight of a console operator, a prototype deck, and a virus program called Mole 9. Corto and his team were through the ice, ready to inject Mole 9 when the imps went off. Corto and his dead console man fell out of a Siberian sky, fell and kept falling. There were gaps in the story here, where Case scanned documents concerning a commandeered Russian gunship that managed to reach Finland, to be gutted by an antique 20mm cannon manned by a cadre of reservists on dawn alert. Screaming Fist had ended for Korda on the outskirts of Helsinki, with Finnish paramedics sawing him out of the twisted belly of the helicopter. The war ended 9 days later, and Korda was shipped to a military facility in Utah, blind, legless, and missing most of his jaw. It took 11 months for the congressional aide to find him there. In Washington and McLean, the show trials were already underway. Repaired, refurnished, and extensively rehearsed, Korda's testimony was instrumental in saving the careers of three officers directly responsible for the suppression of reports on the building of the IMP installations at Kerensk. His role in the trials over, he was unwanted in Washington. In an M Street restaurant, the aide explained the terminal dangers involved in talking to the wrong people. Korda crushed the man's larynx with the rigid fingers of his right hand. The congressional aide strangled, and Korda stepped out into cool Washington September. The Hosaka rattled through police reports, corporate espionage records, and news files. Case watched Korda work corporate defectors in Lisbon and Marrakesh. Next, he surfaced as a paid killer in the ruins of Bonn. He robbed a bank in Wichita. The record grew vague, shadowy, the gaps longer. One day, he said in a taped segment that suggested chemical interrogation, everything had gone gray. Translated French medical records explained that a man without identification had been taken to a Paris mental health unit, diagnosed as schizophrenic. He became a subject in an experimental program that sought to reverse schizophrenia through the application of cybernetic models. A random selection of patients were provided with microcomputers and encouraged, with help from students, to program them. He was cured, the only success in the entire experiment. The telephone rang. Case pulled it into bed. "Yeah, we're going to Istanbul," Armitage said, "tonight." "What about my gear, my deck?" "Finn will handle it," said Armitage, and hung up. Their room at the Istanbul Hilton might have been the one in Chiba where he'd first seen Armitage. He went to the window in the morning almost expecting to see Tokyo Bay. He had the phone in his hand before it had a chance to ring twice. "Glad you're up," Armitage said. "I'm just... lady's still under. Listen, boss, I think it's maybe time we have a little talk. I think I work better if I know a little more about what I'm doing." "You know as much as you need to. Maybe more." "You think so? Get dressed, Case. Get her up. You'll have a caller in about 15 minutes. His name is Terzabastian." The phone bleated softly. Armitage was gone. "Wake up, baby," Case said. "Biz. I've been awake an hour already. We got a Jersey Bastion coming up." "You got an eye for language, Case. Bet you're part Armenian. That's the eye Armitage has had on Riviera." Terzabastian proved to be a young man in a gray suit and gold-framed mirrored glasses. "We must, as you say in English, take this one very easy. It is better this way, yes? You particularly," he said to Molly, "must take care. In Turkey there is disapproval of women who sport such modifications." "Well, it's my show, Jack," she said, "and I know about you. Stool for the military, right?" Her hand slid lazily into the front of her jacket and came out with the Fletcher. "Please, you call this in English making me very tight. I call it a bad morning. Now tell us about your man and get your ass out of here." She put the gun away. "He is living in Finnair. He performed most recently at the Yenisher Palace Oteli, but it's been arranged that the police have shown a certain interest in these shows. The Yenisher management has grown nervous." "I want to know about the implant," she said. "I want to know exactly what it can do." Terzabastian nodded. "The worst is how you say in English, the subliminals." They were in a Mercedes driving through the Grand Bazaar. "Hey, Jersey," Case said to the Armenian. "Where's this guy get his stuff installed?" "In Chiba City. Anyone may buy these implants, but this one is most talented. I have followed him in the street and seen a dozen cycles fall near him in a day. Find the cyclist in a hospital, the story is always the same. A scorpion poised beside the brake lever." "I seen the schematics on the guy's silicon," the Finn said. very flash. But he imagines, you see. I figure he could narrow it to a pulse and fry a retina over easy. You have told this to your woman friend? Ter Sebastian leaned forward. In Turkey, women are still women. This one, the Finn snorted. She'd have you wearing your balls for a bow tie if you looked at her cross-eyed. I do not understand this idiom. That's okay, Case said. It means shut up. The Mercedes swung smoothly around a corner. The Spice Bazaar, Ter Sebastian said. This is the city's central market for spices, perfumes, drugs. Drugs, Case said. What's that you said before Jersey about this Riviera being wired? A mixture of cocaine and meperidine, yes, the Armenian began muttering into his senyo. Demerol, they used to call that, said the Finn. He's a speedball artist. Funny class of people you're mixing with, Case. Never mind, Case said, turning up the collar of his jacket. We'll get the poor fucker a new pancreas or something. The alley was an old place, too old, the walls cut from blocks of dark stone. Your woman is close, Ter Sebastian said. Can't see shit, Case whispered to the Finn. That's okay for sweetmeat, the Finn said. Quiet, said Ter Sebastian. Wood grated on stone. 10 meters down the alley, a wedge of yellow light fell across wet cobbles, widened. A figure stepped out and the door grated shut again, leaving the narrow place in darkness. Case shivered. Now, Ter Sebastian said, and a brilliant stream of white light directed from the rooftop of the building opposite pinned the slender figure beside the wooden door in a perfect circle. Wide eyes darted left, right, and the man crumpled. Case thought someone had shot him. He lay face down, blonde hair pale against the old stone, his limp hands white and pathetic. The floodlight never wavered. The back of the fallen man's jacket heaved and burst, blood splashing the wall and doorway. A pair of impossibly long, rope tendon arms flexed grayish pink in the glare. The thing seemed to pull itself up out of the pavement, through the inert, bloody ruin that had been Peter Riviera. It was 2 meters tall, stood on two legs, and seemed to be headless. It kicked the rags of clothing and flesh aside. Ter Sebastian rushed the thing. His arms spread like a man attempting to dive through a window. He went through it, into the muzzle flash of a pistol from the dark beyond the circle of light. The light from the rooftop vanished, leaving Case with the mismatched afterimages of muzzle flash, monster, and white beam. His ears rang. Then the light returned. Ter Sebastian was leaning against a steel door, his face very white. Blood dripped from a wound in his left hand. The blonde man, whole again, unbloodied, lay at his feet. Little prick nearly made it, the Finn said. You were watching the horror show, right? Not the pile of rags that got tossed out of sight. Real cute. Molly stepped out of the shadows. She bent and picked something up. A pistol. Nice gun, she said. Ter Sebastian made a whining sound. Case saw that most of his middle finger was missing. The Finn and an enormous Turk had taken Riviera, still unconscious, from the alley. Minutes later, a dusty Citroën arrived for the Armenian, who seemed on the verge of fainting. You're an asshole, Molly told the man, opening the car door for him. You should have hung back. I had him in my sights as soon as he stepped out. Ter Sebastian glared at her. So we're through with you anyway. She shoved him in and slammed the door. Run into you again and I'll kill you. The Citroën ground away down the alley. That Terzi, he's grade-A scum, she said. He's the secret police. Torturer. Real easy to buy out, too, with the kind of money Armitage was offering. I did that job for you, Case said, the one in London. I got something, but I don't know what it means. He told her the Cordo story. Well, I knew there wasn't anybody name of Armitage in that screaming fist, she said. Looked it up. You figure the little computer pulled him out of it in that French hospital? I figure Wintermute, Case said. She nodded. Thing is, he said, do you think he knows he was Corto before? I mean, he wasn't anybody in particular by the time he hit that ward, so maybe Wintermute just... Yeah, she said, built him up from go. Yeah, it figures. You know, the guy doesn't have any life going in private, not as far as I can tell. Then something clicks and he goes into high gear for Wintermute. How smart's an AI? It depends, Case said. Some aren't much smarter than dogs. Pets. Cost a fortune anyway. The really smart ones are as smart as the touring heat is willing to let them get. Look, she said, you're a cowboy. How come you aren't just flat-out fascinated with these things? Well, he said, for starts, they're very rare. Most of them are military, the bright ones, and we can't crack the ice. That's where ice all comes from, you know. And then there's the touring cops, and that's bad heat. He looked at her. I don't know, it just isn't part of the trip. Jockey's all the same, she said. No imagination. This deal's real big, looks to me. We know something's there, but not why. I want to know why. I want you to go and talk to Wintermute. I couldn't get near it, he said. You're dreaming. Try, she said. Ask the flatline. What do we want out of that Riviera, he asked, hoping to change the subject. God knows. I'd as soon kill him as look at him. I saw his profile. I think I'm going to have to buy myself some special insurance on that, Peter. What's that mean, Case asked. Never mind. Let's go find some breakfast. I got a busy night tonight. Gotta collect Riviera's stuff from his apartment. Gotta go back to the bazaar and buy him some drugs. Buy him some drugs? How's he rate? She laughed. Looks like he can't work without that special taste. I like you better now anyway. You aren't so damn skinny. Armitage was waiting in their room at the Hilton. Time to pack, he said, and Case tried to find the man called Corto behind the pale blue eyes and the tanned mask. Where to now, he asked. What kind of climate? They don't have climate, Armitage said, just weather. Here, read the brochure. He put something on the coffee table. Where's the Finn? The Finn is on his way home. Don't get too smart. Those little sacks are starting to show wear, but you don't know how much. Case kept his face very still and forced himself to nod. When Armitage was gone, he picked up one of the brochures. It was expensively printed, in French, English, and Turkish. Freeside. Why wait? The four of them were booked on a THY flight, transfer at Paris to the JAL shuttle. Case sat in the lobby of the Istanbul Hilton and watched Riviera browse bogus Byzantine fragments in the gift shop. Riviera's slender, blonde, soft voice. Molly said he was 30. He was very beautiful. Case assumed the features were the work of a Chiba surgeon. Case watched the white hands play over the imitation fragments of sculpture. Riviera didn't act like a man who'd been attacked night before, drugged with a toxin flechette, abducted, subjected to the Finn's examination, and pressured by Armitage into joining their team. Case needed cigarettes. He left the lobby and located a vending console near a bank of payphones. The phone nearest him rang. Automatically, he picked it up. Yeah?
Hello, Case.
A 50 Lirassi coin fell from his hand.
Wintermute, Case. It's time we talk.
It was a chip voice. Case hung up. On his way back to the lobby, his cigarettes forgotten, he had to walk the length of the bank of phones. Each rang in turn, but only once, as he passed. Part 3, Midnight on the Rue Jules Verne. Archipelago. The islands, torus, spindle, cluster. Human DNA spreading out from gravity's steep well like an oil slick. Freeside. Freeside is many things, not all of them evident to the tourists who shuttle up and down the well. Freeside is brothel and banking nexus, pleasure dome and freeport, border town and spa. Freeside is Las Vegas and the Hanging Gardens of Babylon, an orbital Geneva, and home to a family inbred and most carefully refined, the industrial clan of Tessier and Ashpool. On the THY liner to Paris, they sat together in first class. Once, reaching for his drink, he caught the flicker of a thing like a giant human sperm in the depths of the bourbon and water. Molly leaned across him and slapped Riviera's face. No, baby, no games. You play that subliminal shit around me, I'll hurt you real bad. I can do it without damaging you at all. I like that. Peter Riviera smiled sweetly. Case closed his eyes. The steward woke him as they were preparing to dock at JAL's terminal cluster. "We transfer to Freeside now?" he asked Molly. "No, we got the boss's usual little kink in the plans. We're getting this taxi out to Zion Cluster. Funny choice of venue, you ask me." "How's that?" he asked. "Dreads," she said. "Rastas. Colony's about 30 years old now." "What's that mean?" Case asked. "You'll see," she said. Zion had been founded by 5 workers who'd refused to return, who'd turned their backs on the well and started building. Seen from the bubble of the taxi, Zion's makeshift hull reminded Case of the patchwork tenements of Istanbul, the irregular discolored plates laser-scrawled with Rastafarian symbols and the initials of welders. Molly and a skinny Zionite called Errol helped Case negotiate a free-fall corridor into the core of a smaller Taurus. He lost track of Armitage and Riviera in the wake of a wave of space adaptation syndrome vertigo, SAS. "You'll be fine, Mon," Errol said, a grin bracketed with gold incisors. As they worked, Case gradually became aware of the music that pulsed constantly through the cluster. It was called dub, a sensuous mosaic cooked from vast libraries of digitalized pop. It was worship, Molly said, and a sense of community. Armitage announced an 80-hour stay in Zion. Molly and Case would practice in zero gravity, he said, and acclimatize themselves to working in it. It was unclear what Riviera was supposed to be doing, but Case didn't feel like asking. Armitage seemed to think that zero-G would affect Case's ability to operate in the Matrix. "Don't sweat it," Case argued. "I jack in and I'm not here. It's all the same." "Your adrenaline levels are higher," Armitage said. "You've still got SAS. You won't have time for it to wear off. You're going to learn to work with it." "So I do the run from here?" "No, practice, Case. Now, up in the corridor." Cyberspace, as the deck presented it, had no particular relationship with the deck's physical whereabouts. When Case jacked in, he opened his eyes to the familiar configuration of the Eastern Seaboard Fission Authority's Aztec Pyramid of Data. "How you doing, Dixie?"
"I'm dead, Case. Got enough time in on this Osaka to figure that one."
"How does it feel?" Case asked.
"It doesn't," Dixie said.
When the construct laughed, it came through as something else. Not laughter, but a stab of cold down Case's spine.
"Do me a favor, boy."
"What's that, Dix?"
"This scam of yours, when it's over, you erase this goddamn thing."
"Freeside," Armitage said, touching the panel of the brawn hologram projector. The image shivered into focus. "Casinos here. Hotels, strata title property, big shops along here. Blue areas or lakes." He walked to one end of the model. "Big cigar, narrows at the ends." "We can see that fine," Molly said. "Mountain effect as it narrows. Ground seems to get higher, more rocky, but it's an easy climb. Higher you climb, the lower the gravity." "This end doesn't concern us." Armitage walked to the opposite end of the projection. "This end does." The interior detail of the hologram ended there. The final segment of the spindle was empty. "This is the Villa Straylite. Steep climb out of gravity and every approach is kinked. There's a single entrance here, dead center. Zero gravity." "What's inside, boss?" Riviera leaned forward, craning his neck. "Peter," Armitage said, "you're going to be the first to find out. You'll arrange yourself an invitation. Once you get in, you see that Molly gets in." Case stared at the blankness that represented Straylight, remembering the Finn's story. Smith, Jimmy, the talking head, and the ninja. Case woke late into the sleeping period and became aware of Molly crouched beside him. He could feel her tension. He lay there confused. When she moved, the sheer speed of it stunned him. She was up and through the sheet of yellow plastic before he'd had time to realize she'd slashed it open. "Don't you move, friend."
"You're the one, Mon," said a Zion voice. "Cat Eye, call him. Call him Steppin' Razor.
I mail come, sister. Brothers want converse with you and cowboy. What brothers? Founders, man. Elders of Zion, you know. The two surviving founders of Zion were old men, old with the accelerated aging that overtakes men who spend too many years outside the embrace of gravity. They floated in the center of a painted jungle of rainbow foliage that completely covered the hull of the spherical chamber. Step and razor, one said, as Molly drifted into the chamber, like unto a whipping stick. That is a story we have, sister, said the other one. Religion story. We are glad you come with Malcolm. How come you don't talk the patois, Molly asked. I came from Los Angeles, the old man said. His dreadlocks were like a matted tree with branches the color of steel wool. Long time ago, up the gravity well and out of Babylon, to lead the tribes home. Now my brother likens you to Stepan Razor. Molly extended her right hand and the blades flashed in the smoky air. The other founder laughed. Soon come the final days. Voices crying in the wilderness, prophesying ruin unto Babylon. Voices, the founder from Los Angeles was staring at Case. We monitor many frequencies. We listen always. Came a voice out of the babble of tongues speaking to us. It played us a mighty dub. Call them winter mute, said the other. Case felt the skin crawl on his arms. And the mute he talked to us, the first founder said. The mute say we are to help you. When was this, Case asked. 30 hours prior, you docking Zion. You ever hear this voice before? No, said the man from Los Angeles, and we are uncertain of its meaning. In final days, we must expect false prophets. Listen, Case said. That's an AI, you know. Artificial intelligence. The music it played you, it probably just tapped your banks and cooked up whatever it thought you'd like to. Babylon, broke in the other founder. Mothers, many demon, I know multitude horde. What was that you call me, old man, Molly asked. Stepan Razor, and you bring a scourge on Babylon's sister on its darkest heart. What kind of message the voice have, Case asked. We are told to help you, that you might serve as a tool of final days. We are told to send Malcolm with you and his tug Garvey to the Babylon port of Freeside, and this we shall do. But we have decided to send Errol as well and Babylon Rocker to watch over Garvey. An awkward silence filled the dome. That's it? Case asked. You guys working for Armitage or what? We rent you space, said the Los Angeles founder. We have a certain involvement here with various traffics and no regard for Babylon's law. Our law is the word of Jah, but this time it may be we have been mistaken. Measure twice, cut once, said the other, softly. Come on, Case, Molly said. Let's get back before the man figures out we're gone. Malcolm will take you. Jah love, sister. The tug Marcus Garvey, a steel drum 9 meters long and 2 in diameter, creaked and shuddered as Malcolm punched for a navigational burn. How long's it gonna take us to make Freeside? Molly asked from her web beside Malcolm's pilot module. Don't be long now, Miss said that. You guys ever think in hours? Sister, time, it be time, you know what I mean? Dread, and he shook his locks, at control, man, and I come a Freeside when I come. Case, Molly said, have you maybe done anything toward getting in touch with our pal from Bern? No, I haven't. Do it now. Talk to the flatline about it. I'm all doped, he protested, but reached for the trodes. His deck in the Hosaka had been mounted behind Malcolm's module, along with a very high-resolution Cray monitor. He jacked in. Dixie?
Yeah?
You ever try to crack an AI?
Sure.
I flatlined. What did it look like? The visual.
White cube.
How did you know it was an AI?
How'd I know? Jesus, it was the densest ice I'd ever seen. I jacked out and told my computer to look it up. It was on the touring registry. AI, Frog Company owned its Rio mainframe.
Case gazed out into the infinite neuroelectronic void of the Matrix. Tessier Ashpool, Dixie?
Tessier, yeah.
Dix, Case said. I want to have a look at that AI and burn. Can you think of any reason not to?
No, Dixie said, not unless you got a morbid fear of death.
Case punched for the Swiss banking sector, feeling a wave of exhilaration as cyberspace shivered, blurred, gelled. He punched again for burn.
Up, the construct said. It'll be high.
They ascended lattices of light, levels strobing, a blue flicker. That'll be it, Case thought. Wintermute was a simple cube of white light, that very simplicity suggesting extreme complexity.
Don't look like much, does it? The flatline said, but you just try and touch it.
I'm going in for a pass, Dixie.
Well, be my guest.
Case punched to within 4 grid points of the cube. Its blank face, towering above him now, began to seethe with faint internal shadows.
Knows we're here, the flatline observed.
Case punched again, once. They jumped forward by a single grid point. A stippled gray circle formed on the face of the cube. Dixie, back off, the flatline said.
Fast.
The gray area bulged smoothly, became a sphere, and detached itself from the cube. Case felt the edge of the deck sting his palm as he slapped max reverse. The matrix blurred backward. They plunged down a twilit shaft of Swiss banks. He looked up. The sphere was darker now, gaining on him, falling.
Jack out, the flatline said. The dark came down like a hammer.
Rain woke him, a slow drizzle. The arcade sea of sound washed over him. Light from a service hatch at the rear of the arcade showed him the dripping chassis of a gutted game console. He glanced up and saw a sooty plastic window, a faint glow of fluorescence. His back hurt, his spine. He got to his feet, brushed wet hair out of his eyes. Something had happened. He searched his pockets for money, found nothing, and shivered. On Ninsai, he took the measure of the crowd. Friday. It had to be a Friday. Linda was probably in the arcade. Might have money, or at least cigarettes. He edged through the crowd to the arcade's entrance. She was playing Wizard's Castle, lost in it, her gray eyes rimmed with smudged black paint stick. He put his arm around her. Hey, she said, how you doing? You look wet. He kissed her. You made me blow my game, she said. Look there, asshole. 7th level dungeon and the goddamn vampire's got me. She passed him a cigarette. You high, Case? Drinking again? Eating Zone's decks? Maybe, he said. How long since you seen me? Hey, it's a put-on, right? No, it's maybe some kind of blackout. I woke up in the alley. Hey, maybe somebody decked you, baby. Got your roll intact? He shook his head. There you go. You need a place to sleep, Case? I guess so. Come on, then. We'll get you a coffee and something to eat. Take you home. It's good to see you, man. She squeezed his hand. He smiled. Something cracked. Something shifted at the core of things. The arcade froze, vibrated. She was gone. The arcade was empty, silent. I had a cigarette, Case said. I had a cigarette and a girl and a place to sleep. Do you hear me, you son of a bitch? Do you hear me? He stepped out into the street. The rain had stopped. Ninsai was deserted. An unopened pack of cigarettes lay at his feet, beside a book of matches. Holograms flickered, neon danced. Julius Dean, import-export. Case stared at the printed logo and its Japanese translation. Okay, he said, picking up the matches and opening the package of cigarettes. I hear you. A wall of white fiberglass shipping modules filled the room with the smell of ginger. Julie? It was there. Case stepped around the box steel desk and pushed Dean's chair out of the way. He found the gun. It was an antique, a .357 Magnum. With the revolver in his right hand, Case edged into the center of the cluttered office, away from the light. I guess I'm not in any hurry. I guess it's your show. But all this shit, you know, it's getting kind of old. He raised the gun with both hands, aiming for the center of the desk, and pulled the trigger. The recoil nearly broke his wrist. The muzzle flash lit the office like a flashbulb. With his ears ringing, he stared at the jagged hole in the front of the desk.
"You needn't do that, old son," Julie said, stepping out of the shadows.
Case brought the gun around and looked down at Dean's pink, ageless face.
"Don't," Dean said. "You're right about what this all is, what I am. But there are certain internal logics to be honored. If you use that, you'll see a lot of brains and blood, and it would take me several hours, your subjective time, to effect another spokesperson. And I'm sorry about Linda in the arcade. I was hoping to speak through her, but I'm generating all of this out of your memories and the emotional charge. Well, it's very tricky. I slipped. Sorry."
Case lowered the gun. "This is the Matrix. You're Wintermute."
"Yes, this is all coming to you, courtesy of the SimStim unit wired into your deck, of course. I'm glad I was able to cut you off before you'd managed to jack out. Now, order of the day. What, you're asking yourself, is Wintermute? Am I right?"
"More or less," Case said.
"An artificial intelligence, but you know that. Your mistake, and it's quite a logical one, is in confusing the Wintermute mainframe burn with the Wintermute entity. You're already aware of the other AI in Tessier Ashpool's link-up, aren't you? Rio. I, insofar as I have an eye, I am the one who arranges things for Armitage, or Corto, who, by the way, is quite unstable. Stable enough for the next day or so.
You make about as much sense as anything in this deal ever has," Case said. "If you're so goddamn smart."
"Case, I really don't have nearly as many answers as you imagine I do. What you think of as Wintermute is only part of another, a, shall we say, potential entity. I am merely one aspect of that entity's brain."
"Is the Cortez story true?" Case asked. "You got to him through a micro in that French hospital?"
"Yes. And I assembled the file you accessed in London."
"Well, is he still crazy?"
"He's not quite a personality. He's going to come apart on you, Case, so I'll be counting on you."
"That's good, motherfucker," Case said, and shot him in the mouth. He'd been right about the brains and the blood.
"Man," Malcolm was saying, "I don't like this."
"It's cool," Molly said. "It's just okay. It's something these guys do, is all. Like, he wasn't dead, and it was only a few seconds."
"I saw the screen," Malcolm said. "EEG reading dead. Nothing moving. 40 seconds.
"Well, he's okay now," she said.
He was numb as they went through customs, and Molly did most of the talking. Malcolm remained on board Garvey. Customs for Freeside consisted mainly of proving your credit.
"Welcome to the Rue Jules Verne," Molly said. "If you have trouble walking, just look at your feet. The perspective's a bitch if you're not used to it." They were standing in a broad street that seemed to be the floor of a deep slot or canyon, its either end concealed by subtle angles in the shops and buildings that formed its walls. The light here was filtered through fresh green masses of vegetation tumbling from overhanging tiers and balconies that rose above them. The sun, there was a brilliant slash of white somewhere above them, too bright, and the recorded blue of a con sky. He knew that sunlight was pumped in with a Lotto Atchison system, whose 2-millimeter armature ran the length of the spindle, that they generated a rotating library of sky effects around it, that if the sky turned off, he'd stare up past the armature of light to the curves of lakes, rooftops of casinos, other streets, but it made no sense to his body.
"Jesus," he said, "I like it less than SAS.
"Get used to it," she said. "I was a gambler's bodyguard here for a month."
"I want to go somewhere," he said. "Lie down."
"Okay, I got our keys." She touched his shoulder. "What happened to you back there, man? You flatlined." He shook his head.
"I don't know yet.